All right. Thank you very much. So I'm going to be talking about an interview study that I did with my student, Janine Slaker, about a year and a half ago. So what you see here on the slide is an activity tracker that was available around the time that we were doing this study. It's called the Fitbit Charge HR. It has sensors in it, like an accelerometer and an altimeter and a heart rate sensor. And people wear activity trackers like this on their wrists, and they use them to passively collect data about their actions and various aspects of their activities. So back in early February of 2016, there was a guy who noticed that the heart rate sensor in his wife's Fitbit was acting a little weird. It said that she had spent over 10 hours in what the device was saying was like the fat burn zone in terms of her heart rate, which is apparently not very common. So he did what anybody else would do. He asked Reddit about it. He posted on Reddit that his wife's Fitbit was acting weird, and one of the commenters suggested that maybe it wasn't actually broken, maybe it was that his wife was actually pregnant. And it turned out that she was. So what's important about this example? There's this device that has embedded sensors in it that are collecting data all the time for a specific purpose, but that data was used to infer something that was not really related to its intended purpose. And the inference was about something that the users didn't even know was possible in the first place to be able to be undetected from that kind of data. So people are asked to make privacy self-management decisions all the time when they sign up for new services. But the sensor data collection that's going on is ubiquitous, it's seamless, it's invisible, and it's really hard to see how people can be making informed decisions about providing consent for these kinds of uses of their data. They can't really be expected to reason and make informed decisions about what they don't even know is possible. So the question is, what do people know about what these devices are doing? What are they able to learn about from using these systems that will help them make these kinds of choices? So there's a lot we actually don't really know about how non-expert users think about the kinds of data, devices, and systems that have these embedded sensors in them that they use. They don't really know what they're collecting about them. So we think that it's important to better understand how people think about the sensor data collection that's going on, because this constrains the kinds of things that they can reasonably consent to. So in other words, what they think about and what they know about these systems is shaping, we think, their privacy self-management decisions. So we did a study to learn more about how people are thinking about the data these devices are collecting. So we focused on users' folk theories about sensor data collection. Folk theories are ways of understanding. They form out of everyday interactions with technology. So when you use a technology, you learn about it. They help people generate explanations about what happened to them in the past and reason about cause and effect for things that they'll have to do in the future. They help people envision what might happen based on what they already know about what's happened to them in the past. And so the idea is that we can better understand security and privacy decisions that people are making if we can learn about their folk theories about the technologies that they use. So for our study, we focused on activity trackers because they're an example of a wearable sensor technology that's relatively inexpensive and has been widely adopted. A lot of people have activity trackers. Activity trackers that are dedicated devices, like the ones this guy's wearing in the slide, they typically have an associated smartphone app that has a user interface, so the device syncs with the smartphone, and then the app is what shows them information about their activities. So they use the UI of the app to interact with their data. But there are also apps that are just for smartphones that use the sensors inside the actual smartphone to do similar things to what the wearable devices do, although usually not as accurately. So we interviewed 30 participants who were current or former activity tracker users. They were not technical experts, and they were also not quantified self-enthusiasts, because we basically wanted to avoid people who would be overly knowledgeable or interested in the sort of technical aspects of how the devices work, and also not people who are obsessed with collecting data about themselves. Our subjects were 80% women. They ranged in age from 23 to 48. 19 out of the 30 used a dedicated activity tracker device, and 17 out of those 19 were Fitbits. The rest of them used smartphones that had apps on them, and we didn't have anybody in our study that used a smartwatch. So to collect our data, we used an elicitation technique from anthropology called a free list. And in a free list, you choose a prompt that describes the domain that you're interested in asking people about. And then you ask them to name as many examples as they can of items or concepts in that domain. So the prompt that we used for our free list task was information that an activity tracker knows. And the goal here is to learn about concepts in that domain that you've provided in the prompt to the participant and the relationships that they have among the concepts. So you want to understand the problem from the perspective of the participants, not necessarily from your own perspective as a researcher. So we didn't do any training. We only interacted with them using words that they had used. We didn't sort of insert our own words for things into the conversation. We tried not to let our knowledge about what was going on sort of color their kinds of responses. Really, it's just sort of listening to them and then clarifying what they've said. So the participant lists when they run out of ideas to list. Then we started following up, asking them questions to clarify terminology, and also we followed up with the prompt, can you tell me how you think it knows X? Because we wanted to get at different kinds of relationships that people might have between different kinds of information, experiences that they'd had that allowed them to know that it was collecting certain kinds of information. So to analyze the data, basically what you have to do initially is you have to go through the lists and through the transcripts and kind of try to standardize the terms so that you can count how many people mentioned a particular concept. So we looked at the words that they used to talk about types of information, and we also looked at the verbs that they used when they answered the question, how does it know? And so that way we could then count the number of people who had mentioned certain types of information and certain relationships between things. So this is a typical example of this quote on the slide of what one of the participants said to us when we asked them, how do you think it knows calories burned? So the participant said, I think, based on the metrics I've given it, my age, my height, my weight, so it knows all of that, and then it calculates, based on my average activity level, how many calories I've burned for the day. And this was a pretty typical kind of response to that follow-up question, how does it know? So at this point, I need to do a small digression about where the data come from that these activity trackers are collecting. And I have two examples I want to talk about, so steps and heart rate. The devices have accelerometers in them, which basically detect acceleration forces. It's a chip inside the activity tracker. The heart rate is detected based on an optical heart rate sensor. So it shines a green LED through the skin. Then there's an optical sensor in the device that gets the green light as it's reflected back out, and that's how it's detecting the heart rate. So the accelerometer and the heart rate monitor, they don't know what a step looks like, they don't know what a heartbeat looks like, they're just collecting these readings from the environment. And then the sensor data are transformed into the numbers that are provided to the users in the UI for their devices. So what you're seeing on the slide here, you're not really intended to be able to read it. I'm going to go over a couple of examples. But these are all the different kinds of information that people mentioned their activity trackers knowing. So I'm going to talk about these three categories here in a minute. But from what they said about the kinds of information and about the relationships between them, we were able to identify three different kinds of folk theories people had about where their data came from. So the first one is entered data, and weight is a really good example of this. It's basically just what it sounds like. It's data that the participant actually had to sort of manually input into the device. So weight, height, how many glasses of water you've had in a day, that sort of thing. So it wasn't based on any other kind of data. It was information they put in themselves. And the verbs that they used to talk about this make that really clear. It was like inputting, giving, entering, and logging. The second kind of folk theory that we identified was for measured data. And we called this one measured data because it seemed like participants were talking about it as if it was like you're taking your temperature. There's a sensor, it's detecting my steps, it's detecting my heart rate. So it didn't have any other data types it was based on. They said it was based on the sensor. And it was doing things like tracking or measuring or seeing. So it was as if it was just picking up the information from the physical environment. And then the third kind of folk theory that we identified, we called calculated data. And calories burned is a really good example of this. You can see that there is a really long list of other data types that they felt calories burned was based on. So things like steps and activity level and age and weight and duration active and heart rate. And this isn't even the whole list of things that they thought that calories burned was based on. They also talked about calculations. So the verbs that they used were like calculating and translating. So these three different kinds of folk theories were things that emerged very strongly from our data. But then we wanted to look at what kinds of experiences people were having that allowed them to form these kind of folk theories in the first place. So where do they even come from? And I'm going to talk about a couple of anecdotes from our data to show you how people are learning these things. So what you see on the slide here is a screen capture from what the Fitbit interface looked like when we collected the data. It looks a little bit different now. But what you can see here is that there are a bunch of different numbers shown on the screen. So how many steps, there's a distance one, there's how many floors you've gone up, there's then calories burned at the bottom. And people talked about how seeing these numbers changing together at the same time in the interface was how they figured out that they must be related somehow. So steps and distance and calories burned, they all increase together throughout the day, so therefore each step must be connected to a certain number of calories burned. So here's a quote from one of our participants. Really, like however you walked, it shows how many calories that you've burned. And so this demonstrates that the participant has connected calories and walking, or steps, because that's how it's shown to them by the tracker. So some activity trackers, you may be aware of if you have one, have a sleep tracking functionality. So if you wear it at night, then it provides information about your sleep patterns to you as well. And the tracker is actually using the same accelerometer that it uses to detect steps, to detect sleep patterns. But the participants talked about this very, very differently. So they talked about steps as if they were counted or calculated sometimes, while they talked about sleep as being monitored or watched, even though it was the same technology that was doing the detecting or the counting or whatever. And the way they talked about it, it was like steps are this discrete action that you can actually observe as you're doing it. So you could get up and walk around this room and you could count how many steps you were taking if you really wanted to. But when you're sleeping, you're unconscious. And so you can't really check and verify that what the tracker is actually detecting is what you're sort of physically experiencing. So participants expressed a lot of uncertainty about their sleep data and about the patterns that it was collecting because they couldn't really directly verify what it was doing. So again, here on the screen, you see a different activity tracker that sort of has a close-up of a heart rate sensor on the back. So that's where the green LED light comes from. And the heart rate sensor is different than the other sensors that are in the device because it's actually visible on the outside of the device. So people can sometimes even see the green LED actually working, whereas they can't really see the accelerometer on the inside. So when they talked about heart rate data collection, they were really focused on the actual physical sensor, like where it's worn and how they could see evidence of the sensor actually working. So there were a lot of participants, like the participant whose quote is on the slide here, that talked in detail about the physical part of the body where they had to wear the tracker in order for the heart rate detection to work properly. So this participant said, the one that I have, the Charge HR, it measures your heart rate based on your wrist. There's a sensor that I don't know the specifics of that you wear one finger away from your wrist. So it's tracking your heart rate there. And we think that the visibility of the sensor made that sensor more salient to them. And then being able to see it working made it seem like it was taking a measurement from the world and not necessarily producing an estimate. And then in my last sort of anecdote, there were times that our participants noticed discrepancies between their own perceptions of their movements and between what the tracker was telling them. So this, whenever they noticed this happening, it made them wonder, like, how the heck is it working? What is it doing? So one of our participants talked about a time where she was at a show with a friend, and as they're clapping, they noticed that the screens on their devices were lighting up. So that sort of made it obvious to them that something was going on. And so then she said, and so then after the next song, we clapped again, and we looked before we clapped at the number of steps he had, and then he clapped, and then he looked again, and it was higher. So this was the experience that sort of clued her into the fact that the tracker she wore on her wrist wasn't actually physically measuring the steps that she was taking. And to some of us, that maybe seems obvious, but these things are sort of sold and marketed as if they're counting steps. And so it took this kind of an experience for her to realize that maybe that wasn't really what was going on. So the raw sensor data, the readings from the sensors themselves, are not actually meaningful to users. So they don't actually ever see that information. that activity trackers are doing work on the behalf of the user to transform those sensor readings into things that are meaningful that the users can interpret and use in their daily lives. But all of that work is hidden from the user, so they can't experience it. And this means they can't incorporate that kind of thing into the folk theories that they're developing about how the technologies work. And we feel like that this could potentially be a really big challenge for the development of folk theories that are helpful for reasoning about different kinds of data collection and inferences that might be possible. So if they're interpreting the numbers that they're shown in the UI as if they're facts about the world instead of estimates, then that would prevent them from thinking, oh, when it's collecting this kind of data about me, the next time they don't read a privacy policy, then they might not be able to reason about what they're actually allowing consent for. So it may actually be better for these systems to be a little bit less seamless and a little bit less ubiquitous and provide a little bit more information about the hidden work that's going on. So how might we actually go about doing this? Well, there's a couple of ideas in the paper, and I'm going to talk about a couple of them here. So seeing values at the same time changing in the UI helped people in our study speculate about dependencies between different data types. And so it might be possible to just insert a little bit more information into some of this feedback that they're getting that's not maybe necessarily directly related to the activity tracking, but it's kind of tangential. It might be kind of interesting. So when it's reporting sleep patterns, the interface could say something like, your average bedtime is 11:23 p.m., which is 20 minutes later than other users in your age group. And it's, in other studies of activity trackers in the HCI community, people have actually asked for a little bit more contextual information that would allow them to compare themselves to other activity tracker users. This is something people seem to be interested in. Then another idea is that it may be really difficult for people to actually pay attention to inactivity. So how many minutes have you guys been sitting here listening to me talk? I know because I have the number on my screen, but you probably don't have a timer. But a tracker could do this really easily. So trackers might be able to provide information about the absence of activity, which is actually something that people would have a hard time paying attention to, that might clue them in a little bit more to what's going on behind the scenes. And then perhaps it could be sort of categorized by GPS location or something like that and used to sort of infer when you're at work versus when you're at home or something like that to tie a little bit more of these data types together. So these are both examples of how data might be combined a little bit differently or communicated to the user a little bit differently in ways that might help them speculate about the context of how this data is produced. And we would like to suggest, based on this work, that designing to support speculation might actually help people form folk theories that are more diverse and more complex, which could help them make more informed privacy self-management decisions. Thank you.
Thank you for that talk. I thought it was interesting when you mentioned that the couple who kind of realized that clapping made the steps go up. Did you dig any deeper into how that kind of changed their perception on the privacy of their data?
They didn't really talk about privacy too much. So that particular woman was really, really interested in making sure that her tracker was accurate. And so that experience basically made her feel like she couldn't trust it anymore, so she stopped using it.
I can get that.
Yeah.
Thanks very much for the work. If you hang out too much at security conferences, there's almost like this extra category of calculated data, which is, nefarious things that can be inferred from sensor readings, like, oh, from the same sensors that go into step count, maybe we can figure out your password based on the way you're moving.
Right. Like
that. And so there's almost this like factor of, do people realize that the calculated data is calculated because the interface shows it to them? Or do they realize things are being or could be calculated if the interface never talks to them about it? So I'm curious if that ever came up in the study or if that's something that just doesn't percolate up to users who aren't like deeply embedded in the security community.
So, one of the things that came through pretty strongly was that idea that privacy is contextual. So very few people had any idea that information that wasn't related to activity and exercise is something that could come out of these things. People who talked about tracking a run and using GPS, none of them said where I live is something that the tracker could infer. I think that's a really big challenge for asking people to allow other kinds of uses, is that it's really hard to sort of get them out of that zone of this is what I'm using it for. And so some of the design ideas we had were trying to sort of give a little trail of breadcrumbs to people to think, well, maybe if it's doing this, it could do something else too.
Hi, very interesting work. In fact, the clap to make your steps go up, that's a well-known way to keep your steps going up. In fact, I'm a biker instead of a, and, you know, it tells
you
that
you've done
absolutely nothing. You have been laying around all day. I was interested to see if you were thinking towards using this information not just as a fitness thing, but as an activity tracker to see if an elderly person that lives alone, you know, are they moving? As like the husband who looked at his wife's data to see what her burn rate, which I thought was really intrusive on his part.
Right.
You know, just because then, you know, once again, your folk stories then are become much more important because they aren't going to understand as much about how the whole thing works.
So that didn't come up in this particular part of the interview study. After we had finished the free list task, we gave people some hypothetical scenarios about things that it might be possible for the tracker to infer. We're still sort of working on writing up that part of the interview. Suggesting to people that the data might be used to infer something like how many times you've gone to the bathroom during the day. Then got them into thinking more about a health mindset instead of a fitness mindset. And that was when people started making suggestions about, oh, this might be really great for my elderly mother kind of a situation.
Thanks.
Hi, I thought that was a great talk. Thanks very much. So in the Internet of Things, there's sort of pervasive sensors, very much like, you know, wearable sensors, except often these are invisible and kind of, you know, stashed away in the corner of the room, you know, lingering, invisible. So I was just wondering if you might speculate a little bit on how your methodology might be adapted to suit those types of, you know, folklore and so on.
Right. I mean, we did have one really big advantage, which is people who are wearing activity trackers are making a conscious choice to do that, right?
Right.
So it's a device that you can see. It's, you know, if you wear it on your wrist, then it's obvious to you that you're wearing it. I think that one of the things that we thought about was interviewing people who use baby monitors, for example, because that's a pervasive video technology, but it's also one that you've chosen to use and you're using it for a specific purpose to try to kind of use that as a gateway into talking to people about these issues and then sort of moving the interview in the direction of other kinds of sort of video surveillance and stuff like that. But you're right, that's a really big chance. If they're not even aware of it, of the technology at all, then it's hard to ask them about it.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.